This is a Kim Monson news briefing.
The inkstand that a free people made for itself. Wonder Tea Kicker, the instruments of self-government. Lead caption interprets and carries the honest hedge, see caption block below. In a low-lit case in the west wing of Independence Hall, behind glass a visitor can lean close to on a summer morning, sits a piece of silver about the size of a bread loaf, a scalloped tray carrying three vessels, an ink pot in the center, a pot for the fine sand that blotted wet ink, and a stand bristling with a pair of quills. It does not look like the tool of a revolution. It looks like good tableware. A card beside it does the work the object cannot do for itself, and the card is careful. This, it says, is the Sing inkstand, believed to be the silver inkstand in which 56 men dipped their pens to mutually pledge their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor in the cause of independence. A reader in a hurry slides past the second word. It is worth stopping on. Believed. The object under the glass is real, and most of what we say about it is true. A Philadelphia silversmith named Philip Sing Jr. made it in 1752 for the Pennsylvania Assembly, and the Assembly paid him £25, 16 shillings for the work. It stood on the speaker's table in this building for a quarter of a century of ordinary colonial business before the summer that made it famous. The National Park Service, which holds it now, states its origin without a flicker of doubt and its most celebrated use, with a careful, honest hedge, and the gap between those two registers is the record telling the truth about how much it knows. Here is what the object argues, better than any speech. The instruments of American authority were made by a working silversmith for a colonial assembly, not handed down by a crown. No royal regalia, no scepter, no seal sent across an ocean by a king, a standish of Philadelphia silver, ordered like a set of spoons, raised by a tradesman's hands and set on a table where, in time, a people would teach itself to govern. The making is documented beyond dispute. The great use, the signing of the Declaration in 1776, the record supports as a strong inference and never as proof. A second signing, the Constitution in 1787, tradition adds, and the documents do not. The ideals this small silver thing served were larger than any single hand that touched it, and following the object closely, from the bench where it was raised to the case where it rests, is a way of watching a self-governing people build the tools of its own authority, and then, the rarer feat, bind itself under them. Philip Sing Jr. kept a shop on Front Street, just below High Street, a block from his chief rival and in the middle of the richest, busiest city in British North America. He had come from Ireland as a boy, learned the trade, and by his 40s was the silversmith Philadelphia's leading family sent for when they wanted something fine. His hands made the expensive, ordinary furniture of a prosperous colonial life. Tankards and teapots and trays, gold buckles and buttons and teaspoons. In an age before banks, a family's silver was its savings as much as its ornament. Wealth you could set on a table and, in a hard year, melt back into money. When the Pennsylvania Assembly wanted a standish worthy of the speaker's table, it sent for Sing, and in 1752 it paid him £25, 16 shillings, no small sum, for the ink pot, the pounce pot, and the quill stand on their scalloped silver tray. Consider what the thing actually was, because the object is the argument, and the argument is in the details. A standish was the writing machine of its age, and Sing's had three working parts on one tray, the ink pot in the middle, a second pot beside it for the fine sand, a clerk shook over wet ink to blot it dry, and a stand to hold the cut quills upright between strokes. It was silver because the assembly could afford silver, and because silver announced that the body it served was the equal of any in the empire, but its purpose was strictly practical. It held the means of writing things down, and writing things down is the whole of what a legislature does. A self-governing people governs on paper, in statutes and votes and signed engrossments, and it needs, at the head of the table, a good pot of ink. Sing was more than a supplier of handsome objects. He was one of the men who built the civic machinery of a self-governing town. He cut the seals for the library company and the Union Fire Company and the contribution ship that insured Philadelphia's houses against fire. He sat in Benjamin Franklin's Juntot, the club of tradesmen and thinkers that seated half the institutions of the city, and he was a founder of the library company, of the fire company, of the hospital, and of the American Philosophical Society. He inoculated a child against smallpox in 1734, and he stood in the room while Franklin drew electricity out of the air. Franklin, who did not hand out praise cheaply, called Singh his worthy and ingenious friend. When a free town wanted an instrument, it did not petition a monarch. It walked down Front Street to a shop and commissioned one. For 24 years, the Standish did quiet work. It sat on the speaker's table in the assembly room of the Pennsylvania State House, while the colony argued over taxes and roads and its uneasy relations with the crown, and the ink it held dried on the ordinary business of a legislature. Then, in the spring and summer of 1776, the same room filled with a different body, the Second Continental Congress, and the ordinary object found itself under the hands of men doing something that had no precedent. The document we picture was not the one first approved. On July 4, Congress adopted the text and sent it to a printer, John Dunlap, who ran off the broadside sheets that carried the news by horse and packet through the colonies. That first declaration was an act of printing, not of penmanship, a thing set in type in the night and scattered by riders so that a colonel could stand in the statehouse yard on July 8 and read it aloud to a crowd. No delegate dipped a pen in anything to make it, and the famous signatures are nowhere on it. The parchment came later. On July 19, Congress ordered the declaration engrossed, written out by hand in a fair, formal script on a single skin, and a clerk named Timothy Matlack bent to the work. The signing came later still. The popular memory compresses it all into one glorious afternoon, but the historian Herbert Friedenwald, who counted heads a century ago, found that the men in the room shifted from day to day, and that a good many who were imagined signing on the 4th were nowhere near Philadelphia. The engrossed parchment, in the plain words of the journals of the Continental Congress, was signed on a later day, on August 2, 1776, most of the members of the Continental Congress assembled. In the State House, and the Declaration of Independence being engrossed and compared at the table was signed. At the table. This is where the object enters the greatest scene in the nation's founding, and it enters it quietly, because no one that day was writing down which inkwell the pens were dipped in. What we have instead is the memory of a man who was there. 35 years later, Benjamin Rush, physician and signer, wrote to his old friend John Adams and set down what the 4th of July celebrations never captured, the dread beneath the fireworks. "Do you recollect," he asked Adams, "the pensive and awful silence which pervaded the House when we were called up, one after another, to the table of the President of Congress, to subscribe what was believed by many at that time to be our own death warrants?" The men walked up to the table one at a time. Every one of them knew that the crown would read the parchment as a confession of treason and read the signatures as a list of names to hang. Even the gallows found a joke. Rush remembered Benjamin Harrison of Virginia, a heavy man, turning to the slight Elbridge Gerry at the table and telling him that when they were all hanged for the morning's work, Harrison would have the advantage. "From the size and weight of my body, I shall die in a few minutes, but from the lightness of your body, you will dance in the air an hour or two before you are dead." "A transient smile," Rush wrote, and then the solemnity closed over the room again. The ink on the quills at that table was held in something. The record cannot swear it was this Standish, and honesty requires saying so plainly. The National Park Service, in its own furnishing study of the room, lays out both the case and its limit. No direct evidence has yet been found to sustain this belief, but a strong case can be made for it from available sources. The origin is documented. The Standish stood on that table for years. It was still doing the assembly's writing when Congress arrived. Congress bought itself a glass inkstand in the autumn of 1778, which suggests the silver one had gone back to the assembly by then. If that chain holds, the pens that signed the declaration were dipped in Singh's silver. It is a strong case. It is not a certainty, and the object is more interesting, not less, for standing on an inference honestly named. 11 summers later, the room filled again, and the second act was harder than the first. Throwing off a king is the thrilling half of self-government. The men who had declared themselves free came back to the same Philadelphia room in 1787 to do the rarer and less glorious thing, to write down the rules they would answer to. They worked through the heat with the windows shut against eavesdroppers, building a government clause by clause out of their distrust of every government that had come before, including the one they were making. On September 17, they finished, and 38 men signed 39 names to the engrossed Constitution, three of those present refusing to put their names to it at all. As the last signatures went down, an 81-year-old man watched the chair at the front of the room. Behind the president's seat, the seat George Washington had filled through the long summer, some craftsmen had painted a sun low on the horizon. Franklin had looked at it for months without being able to tell, he said, whether the sun was rising or setting. Now, James Madison recorded, Franklin told the members near him that, at length, he had the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun. The sun belonged to the chair. It is worth keeping the two objects apart, because the popular retelling likes to gather every relic of the founding into one glowing pile. The rising sun was painted on Washington's chair, and the ink, if it was Sing's ink, was in the Standish on the table. Different objects, different makers, one room. Whether the same silver inkstand served this second signing is a question the record does not answer, and here the honest telling parts company with the fond one. The strong inferential case that places the Standish at the Declaration does not extend to the Constitution. The argument that carried 1776 says nothing about 1787. The pairing of the two signings in one instrument lives in an exhibit caption and in a century of affectionate retelling, not in the documentary case. And yet, the tradition is worth taking seriously for what it reaches for, because it fastens on a genuine truth about the object, even if it overstates the object's biography. One instrument, the tradition insists, served both acts, the declaring and the binding, and whether or not one Standish of silver did the literal work, the two acts do belong to a single labor. A people that had declared a right in the first room had to return to the second and supply the law that would secure it, or it would have traded a king for nothing. An object that survives long enough stops being a tool and becomes a witness, and the Standish had a long afterlife. It went on doing the assembly's writing after Congress moved on, and it traveled with the state government as the capital drifted west from Philadelphia. It might have vanished, the way most working silver did, melted for its metal when fashion or need called. The furnishing study of the room notes that of the objects once in it, nearly all, no longer exist, and that the era can be represented by only a few objects, specifically by the original inkstand and a coat of arms. It came home in 1875 when Governor John F. Hart Rampft turned it over to the committee preparing Independence Hall for the nation's 100th birthday. In the centennial display that followed, a hall of relics that a promotional book of the day would soon be labeling for tourists, the Sing inkstand had a distinction almost no other piece could claim. Among all the furniture purporting to date to the Revolution, it was the only item of furnishings in the lot dating from 1776. That is the strange arc of the thing. A working object, ordered like tableware and priced like tableware, outlived almost everything around it and became a relic precisely because a free people needed something to point at. The eye wants an artifact. It is easier to feel the weight of the founding standing over a case of silver than reading a clause about enumerated powers, and the museum knows it. And the impulse is an old and understandable one, the same impulse that engrossed the Declaration on skin instead of leaving it a printed sheet, a self-governing people reaching for a thing it can revere, a physical proof that the improbable arrangement really happened, that ordinary people in an ordinary room really did declare themselves free, and then really did write themselves a government. The National Park Service acquired the inkstand with the park in the 20th century, and it sits now where this account began. Under glass in the west wing, a few feet of silver, a citizen can lean over on a summer morning. Liberty is a practice, the ongoing work of a free people rather than a thing they own outright. And the surest proof of it is that such a people has to make the very instruments of its own authority. No crown handed down the silver on that table. A tradesman raised it on commission from men who govern themselves. The Founders' thrilling act was declaring a right that comes from the Creator and not from any king, and their rarer, harder act was returning to the same room the next season to bind themselves under a law of their own writing, because a people that throws off a master and supplies no law in its place has only traded masters. The same labor that this one object gathers into itself, the declaring and the binding, is the labor each generation is handed and cannot inherit finished. The ideals the inkstand served outran the men who made and used it, which is the standing summons of the thing, to hold ourselves to a promise larger than the people who first wrote it down. Reading the documents, sitting in the meetings, and holding our elected representatives to the plain words of the text is the maintenance that keeps a self-governing republic standing. The founders left the question open, and it comes due in every election and every legislative session: will we govern ourselves or be governed? The card in the case will keep saying believed, and that is as it should be, because the honest word carries more than a bolder one could. A great deal of what a free people most wants to touch comes down to it on exactly this kind of evidence: a strong case and an old tradition and a surviving object, rather than a signed receipt. And the Standish holds its ground anyway: a piece of plate that a working hand raised out of sheet silver and a self-governing assembly bought for its speaker's table, set down in a room where men who knew the crown could hang them, walked up one at a time to sign their names, and sitting there still under the low museum light, holding the memory of the ink. For the full article with sources and links, visit kimmonson.com. This has been a Kim Monson News Briefing.